The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Handridge versus Woodbury Spine and Injury. Counsel, as you're getting situated, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 to appellant counsel to use for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of the argument and be mindful of the timing restrictions that you each have. And those restrictions, well, the clock and light in the podium indicate how much time you have left and whether your time is about to expire or has expired. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Will Flegel, and along with Joe Crosby, trial counsel, we represent Jordan Handridge, the appellant in this matter, in her medical malpractice case. The trial court dismissed the claim for alleged noncompliance with expert disclosure requirements of Section 145.682, and we ask this court to reverse the trial court's dismissal of Ms. Handridge's claim because the plaintiffs timely submitted substitute affidavits as allowed under the safe harbor provisions of Subdivision 6C of the statute, and those substitute affidavits were not adjudged to be defective in any manner. Since the safe harbor statute expressly allows a timely substitution, since the trial court did not consider the substitute affidavits, the trial court erred as a matter of law, and reversal is the proper remedy.
So, counsel, where would you point in the record to the assertion below by the plaintiff that those were substitute affidavits that corrected the deficiencies raised in the motion for summary judgment filed by the respondent?
The plaintiff submitted the affidavits both in conjunction with the motion to enlarge and with the submissions in opposition to summary judgment, and they're characterized as 145.682 affidavits on their face.
That's certainly true. I guess what I'm looking for is I see your memorandum in opposition to the motion for summary judgment, and I see the reference to the safe harbor provisions. What I don't see is the argument made, and this is the argument made in respondent's brief. What I don't see is the assertion that the affidavits filed were substitute affidavits to correct the deficiencies raised in the motion for summary judgment.
If they were not specifically identified in that manner, I don't believe that that in any way constitutes anything germane to the resolution of the case. If we look at subdivisions.
Well, you're criticizing the district court for not considering the substitute affidavit.
Right.
So I just want you to connect the dots for me.
Okay. I'm happy to do that. The trial court herself made observations about the affidavits, specifically at her memorandum at page 2. This is document 51 below, reprinted at addendum page 4. The court said with regard to the submissions that these were the expert affidavits of Kenneth Ehrman and Dr. John Wald that were filed on February 8th, 2019. And she also indicated that they, at the same location, continuing to the next page, that those affidavits described an identification of those individuals, the substance and basis for their testimony, the facts and opinions that they would give, and also identified causation, which are the requirements. The statute itself in subdivision 6C requires merely that an affidavit be filed after motion to dismiss has specified deficiencies within the prior affidavit. In this case, the prior affidavit was the pro se affidavit, which the pro se plaintiff called an amended affidavit. I believe she confused there are actually two affidavits, as the court is likely aware, that has to be filed in her, because she submitted a second one. She called it an amended affidavit. So these were clearly intended as supplemental affidavits, Your Honor. All right. We've tried to anticipate what the justification would be for not considering the substitute affidavits in the event that the plaintiff herself, as a pro se party, had not timely submitted an affidavit, then potentially you can't submit a substitute to replace it, but she was timely. She actually submitted what she called her amended affidavit within 10 days of the 180-day time period beginning. If there were an argument that affidavits such as she submitted are simply too bad to count, the Supreme Court in Wesley versus Floor expressly rejected that notion. She's entitled to her rights under the statute, and that would include to submit a curative affidavit. And in this case, once private counsel was retained to assist her, he worked quickly to secure an expert witness, both within the standard of care and on causation, and disclosed those substitute affidavits within 14 days of the 45-day time period. Here it appears as though the trial court began the timer from the date the discovery began, which would be the relevant benchmark for the first affidavit and not for supplemental affidavits. The benchmark that begins the timing for the 45-day time period is the specification within defendant's motion to dismiss of alleged deficiencies. If we'd look at the notice of motion that was filed by the defense here, that's document 32 in the record below. That does not specify any deficiencies. It's simply a motion for summary judgment.
I think opposing counsel has acknowledged that they identified the deficiencies of this second affidavit, the 180-day affidavit that was filed by the pro se plaintiff in their memorandum, which is also your argument.
Yes, on January 25th. The point that I wish to raise is whether we use the starting date as January 2 or we begin the stopwatch on January 25, we're timely with the substitute affidavits under either measure.
You're talking about the 45-day period.
Exactly, okay. Your Honor. We have 45 days from the date of notice. So if notice was given on January the 25th of the deficiencies by means of their incorporation into the brief that the defense filed, then we filed within 14 days of that as the trigger. If we go back to January 2, where there was no specification of any kind, but somehow for some reason that begins the running, then we complied within 38 days of the 45 days. There would be no legitimate legal reason not to consider those affidavits. And the trial court herself, although not considering them and dismissing us based on the initial affidavit filed by the pro se plaintiff, the trial court itself comments that the substitute affidavits meet all of the strictures or requirements of subdivision 4.
Well, I think more accurately, the district court finds that the substitute affidavits, as you call them, the Wald and Ermond affidavits, demonstrate that the plaintiff has a reasonable case on the merits, and the judge is in the first prong of its decision as to whether to enlarge the time, which was based on, you know, the proceedings are a little bit confusing and overlapping in this case, but the judge clearly had deferred the motion for summary judgment and was deciding the plaintiff's motion to enlarge and denied that request.
Right.
I guess what I'm struggling with here is, you know, if the judge denied the request, you leave that as your second issue. I mean, you want us to focus on the dismissal.
We do.
Not on the denial of the enlargement. But clearly to the district court, the denial of the enlargement meant that the plaintiffs were without an affidavit filed within the 180-day period.
She made her decision based on the first affidavit and said it was insufficient because although it had been filed earlier, it lacked the substance that would be required under the statute.
To give the district court some credit, there was never an argument made by the plaintiff that the very first 180-day affidavit filed, so that's actually the second affidavit filed by the pro se plaintiff, so that never contended in response to the defendant's motion for summary judgment that was an adequate affidavit.
We never contended that it was adequate. We never defended it. Instead, we got the substitute affidavits, which is our client's.
Which, again,
right,
is explained by the history of the case, the new counsel, Mr. Crosby coming in, all of that. So,
correct.
I guess what I get, like I said, I'm stuck on the part that the district court judge was faced with this request to enlarge time. She denied it, and having denied it in her discretion, dismiss the plaintiff's case because you had no adequate 180-day affidavit?
She failed to consider the substitute affidavits, which was her responsibility.
But it appears as though you're saying it was her responsibility sua sponte, because I don't see where the plaintiff's submissions to the district court at the time of the enlargement motion said, Judge, look at our substitute affidavits under the safe harbor provision. There's reference made to the safe harbor provision, but not to the substitute affidavits as already curing the deficiencies. That's what I'm looking for, counsel.
Well, Your Honor, in terms of what was required below, it is simply the submission of the affidavits. Perhaps if, I think it's at page 21 of our brief, we may set out the statute there. But basically, the statute provides that what must occur within the time frame of 45 days from the defense specifying deficiencies is that the plaintiff must, before the hearing, serve upon the defendant an amended affidavit or amended answers to interrogatories that correct the claimed deficiencies. And in Wesley, the affidavit that was submitted was from a completely new witness, a substitute witness who actually was qualified. In Wesley, it was another pro se plaintiff who had acquired essentially an affidavit that did not meet the strictures of the statute, and the Supreme Court in Wesley then considered an affidavit submitted by an entirely new expert, which did meet the strictures, to be a substitute affidavit.
Wesley, didn't it analyze it as it's not the expert's affidavit anyway, it's the party's affidavit substituting a new expert?
Thank you, Judge Rodenberg, that's exactly correct. The obligation is not the lawyer's, the obligation is the party's. So what information has been submitted into the record on behalf of that party? In this case, there was a supplemental affidavit. The enlargement issue, I'll just touch on briefly. That's merely a belt and suspenders approach. We had asked for enlargement in the event we had been unable to hurriedly retain, educate, and acquire information once it was acquired that was submitted. We had not, to the point that the enlargement motion was heard, received any specification of any defect of any kind in the supplemental affidavits. So the role that the enlargement request would have served is, in the event that they were specified, we would have a period of time to submit substitute affidavits there.
Enlargement motion was made before the new experts were located.
Correct, Your Honor.
Then you submitted an affidavit of counsel disclosing the new experts, to which I don't know there's never been a deficiency of that noted at all, right?
Correct, Your Honor. That's why the court would likely have to remand for factual findings on the second affidavit.
Circling back to Judge Bradfold's line of questioning, why then, if you have the new affidavit from counsel with the new experts, to which there seems to be no objection, why did you go forward with the motion to enlarge the time?
They would have 45 days. They would have a period of time after we submitted the supplemental affidavits to object to them.
Right, but why did you even go forward with the enlargement motion if you had resolved the affidavit problem under subdivision 6 of 682?
As Mr. Crosby explained at the hearing, and the transcript reflects, the purpose of the enlargement motion was in the event that there was any defect that would have been stated with respect to the supplemental affidavits.
So it was like a peremptory
We try to cover everything in these cases and every possibility or contingency. When the statute 145-682 was initially passed, its purpose was to eliminate frivolous cases. The purpose of the safe harbor statute that was grafted onto it is because cases that were legitimate were now being dismissed based on a gotcha kind of a technicality. So the practice within the plaintiff's bar with respect to these kinds of cases is to use every avenue possible to satisfy those statutory obligations.
I see. So that what you might have been doing, I see what you're saying. So under subdivision 6, the safe harbor itself, if you just submitted the affidavits and then it turned out later that they didn't resolve the problem, you need to have had a sort of a, you'd preserve the request for more time.
Yes, it's an option that we would have at that time, which we would not have if we did not ask for more time. We would be restricted. I believe it's just you have one chance to fix, but one chance from what? From the initial affidavit? Here are our two substitutes. Oh, now they're defective. They didn't talk about causation adequately. Okay, let me fix that. I have 45 days from when you tell me that. That's the purpose of the enlargement, because it preserves or relates back to the original alleged difficulty.
So, counsel, if we decide that the district court erred in dismissing the plaintiff's case as a result of the denial of the enlargement, do we need to reach the denial of the enlargement?
Absolutely not. Thank you. My time's expired.
Thank you. You will have five additional minutes of rebuttal time if you'd like to use that. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court, counsel, Justice Bradfield, you grabbed the issue and you nailed it front on. There was never an opposition to our motion for summary judgment.
Well, there was an opposition to your motion for summary judgment. I read it. It's in the record. It's in your addendum. So
correct.
There's definitely an opposition. What the argument made by counsel below was that your motion for summary judgment could not be resolved by the court under the safe harbor provisions. Now, the precise question I asked of appellate counsel has to do with whether they notified the district court that this is now plaintiff had filed a substitute affidavit that needed to be considered under the safe harbor provision.
And they did not. Right. And I open my argument by stating that, Judge, because there was an issue raised with my initial notice. In response to the initial notice in the motion for summary judgment, they did request relief under the 45-day safe harbor. I chose to eliminate any issues in that regard, Judge. I agreed
passed
to a continuance
at the beginning of the hearing for
correct.
A delay in the hearing on the summary judgment motion. Right?
And I did. It was for purposes that I don't, as counsel says, the plaintiff's bar sometimes views the medical malpractice statute as a gotcha statute. And in this instance, it was anything but gotcha in my defense of this case, giving them every opportunity as the case progressed to comply with all of their obligations. And that started with our answer demanding compliance with MnSTAT Section 145.682. That then
filed a motion to compel.
Had
served my
expert interrogatories.
Yeah.
Didn't respond to.
I'm aware these have been extended proceedings.
Everything. Yep. So I wasn't laying in the weeds, so to speak, and jumped up not having touched my file for 9 months just because, on my calendar, the date passed, time to move for summary judgment. It was.
Well, and you very clearly, in your motion, or at least your memorandum, in support of your motion for summary judgment, you spent some time detailing the deficiencies in the initial 180-day affidavit that was filed by the plaintiff pro se.
Correct, and it's appellant, as they acknowledged, they were wholly deficient, Judge. There was not...
I heard that. There's no argument about it, but we get back to these substitute affidavits and
correct.
What the district court did. Let me ask you a real basic threshold question. So the judge did grant your request at the start of the scheduled summary judgment hearing and did not consider summary judgment at that hearing, right? The
correct.
Judge only looked at, should I grant the motion to enlarge or shouldn't I? And that's what the district court heard arguments on.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, down the pike, April, the judge denied the motion to enlarge, but then took the next step of dismissing the plaintiff's case,
mm-hmm.
right? Where was the district court even faced with a request to dismiss the plaintiff's case as a consequence of denying the motion to enlarge? I didn't see that. Is that somewhere in your submissions?
I did argue it in part at the trial court. The amended notice of motion for summary judgment details, again, the deficiencies that I raised in my memorandum in January of 25, and it also speaks in terms of it essentially...
But
if the motion to enlarge is denied, the case goes away.
Counsel, you're talking about your submission in support of your summary judgment motion.
Okay.
Which, remember, you asked the court not to consider at the February hearing. So what I'm struggling with is, where was the district court faced with a request to dismiss the plaintiff's case?
At oral argument on the motion to enlarge.
And why would dismissal be the next step when there's been additional affidavits filed within the safe harbor period? That's why you're losing me in your argument.
Because they weren't filed and offered for that purpose, Judge. They were offered for purposes of the enlargement only. And if you look at the motion practice, there is a little bit of overlap, but it's not confusing overlap. There was a motion.
You're talking about the submissions that the plaintiff made.
Correct, in support of their motion to enlarge on February 8th of 2019.
I think you got some good support that they're confusing,
yep.
But
yep.
Here's where I struggle. It's your interpretation of the statute. Because I, you know, the argument made by appellant's counsel is, if we look at the safe harbor provision, a defendant obtains dismissal for deficiencies in a 180-day affidavit only on three conditions. I mean, the Supreme Court in Wesley went so far as to say there are three elements before you can get a dismissal. And it's this third element that I think is at issue here, which is whether the plaintiff has served upon the defendant an amended affidavit or answers to interrogatories to correct the alleged deficiencies. So did that happen here?
No.
And why didn't it happen?
You would have to ask them,
what's your basis for that? No, I'm asking you, where in the record did that not happen?
Well, the expert interrogatories, of course, to take the second part of that statute
first. Talking about the amended affidavits.
Never amended. So the interrogatories, although I served expert interrogatories, they didn't take that route, so that's off the table. The first part of that statute requires an amended affidavit, and there was never an attempt to amend the 180-day original affidavit that was filed in this case.
You seem to be making an argument a lot like the one that was raised in Wesley v. Four and rejected by the Supreme Court, because the affidavits are similar in the sense that the substitute affidavits filed by the plaintiffs here are new affidavits of new experts saying new things.
The Wesley court, though, Judge, spoke about in terms of there being a minor change. It was a new expert, but it was parroting maybe is not the right word, but essentially parroting what the internist expert had disclosed in that case. And one of the issues raised with the deficiency was that the original expert was not qualified to offer expert opinion testimony in a dental malpractice case. They proffer a new expert, but along the lines of confirming what the previous expert had to say. So Wesley did not find that superseded the original affidavit, and found that was acceptable. It was an amendment, and it goes on, though, to specifically note that it did not decide the case on the basis of whether or not a wholesale substitution is appropriate. I think the case, the Murillo case, is the case, this Court of Appeals case in Murillo. It's an unpublished case, I know that, but that does then carry the law forward and talks about whether or not an affidavit supersedes or doesn't supersede, and whether it's allowed, in other words, or not allowed. And in this instance, that is what's going on in this case. Regardless of the procedural posture before the district court, in this case, they were attempting, and we'll have to acknowledge, and you can see it from the record before Judge, two brand new experts. And instead of a paragraph in her 180-day affidavit originally, these are four, five, six, seven pages affidavits of new individuals who we had never even heard of until February 8th, with outright opinions on the case. I mean, it was a brand
counsel,
new.
I understand you're relying on the Murillo case, even though it's unpublished, because you think the reasoning is persuasive, right? One of the things that I struggle with between the Wesley versus Flora decision and the Murillo case is a reference in the relevant statute. It is cited in Wesley versus Flora in a footnote, and it's part of subdivision 4B. So the statute itself, the affidavit statute says that nothing in the subdivision may be construed to prevent either party from substituting other expert witnesses. So if that is an overarching direction from the legislature to guide our interpretation of the statute, then how do you prevail on your position that the substitute affidavits filed by the plaintiff in this case cannot be considered under the safe harbor provision?
Because the initial ones were wholly insufficient. This isn't...
But that's exactly when the safe harbor provision is triggered, as I read the statute. It's only for insufficient 180-day affidavits. If they had completely missed the deadline, then you may be right. Perhaps the 180-day provision wouldn't be triggered, or the 45-day safe harbor wouldn't be triggered.
The legislature, and I think if I would have to go back and look at specifically your reading of the Murillo case where they talk about that, but the safe harbor provision, Judge, overriding theme is that the safe harbor provision was not to allow a case to get to the point where you're 500 days after affidavits, the 180-day affidavits should have been disclosed, and you decide at that time, I'm going to start my case anew. I'm going to offer two experts who haven't been identified in this case to date. Discovery has already concluded in the underlying case, and I am going to use those affidavits, as you say, the court sua sponte, to decide that it was offered in the manner that it was, to meet my burden of proof to be able to go forward. It is so far past any reasonable interpretation of what should be allowed that on its face that argument fails on appeal.
If I'm tracking your argument, you're suggesting that this plaintiff's submission of substitute affidavit is so far after the 180 days, it shouldn't even be deemed to trigger the safe harbor?
Provision. I'm saying that even if you get to the point, Judge, where you think that the trial court abused its discretion in not sua sponte considering these affidavits for a purpose for which they were not offered, that if somehow appellants are able to overcome all of those hurdles, if you get to the point where the judge were to look at those, they are, as a matter of law, wholesale substitutions that supersede anything. They're not even correcting anything, Judge, within the 180 days. This is not chiropractor Bradfield says X, and then in response to the safe harbor deficiencies that appellants raise, can come back and fix it a little bit and try to amend the affidavit, not superseding it by any respects, clean up what you have to say a little bit to tie in causation or whatever the applicable standard of care might be. In this instance, it's well beyond that. The court's creating new law well after the fact, well after everything should be disclosed, in allowing the language I use and I put before this court is wholesale substitution of previously and admittedly deficient 180-day expert disclosures. That's something that shouldn't be allowed. That would put defense attorneys, malpractice defense attorneys, legal malpractice defense attorneys into a position that we're constantly chasing our tail, that we can't rely on deadlines in cases under the statute. We can't rely on trial court scheduling order deadlines, that it then reverses the burden of proof onto defendants to not only, you know, raise deficiencies, but allow the appellant to, oh, if those were improper, I'm going to offer new people
if we were to issue a published opinion in your favor, distinguishing Wesley on this point, what is the one line that you would suggest that we use?
The court in Wesley has language in it, and I do raise it in my brief that they do not get so far as to decide on whether what I think the instant case has, that they reach that particular issue. The Wesley court, the Supreme Court decision in Wesley says we leave. I wish I see if I can find it real quick, Judge.
I think what you're referring to is, at least from me, it's a headnote number 5. There's a middle paragraph in Floor that says something to the effect of, we need not and do not decide whether one expert affiant can amend the affidavit of a different expert affiant because we conclude that the affidavits at issue are authored by Wesley and her counsel and not by experts, which is Judge Rodenberg's earlier point.
Page 28 of my brief, correct, I grabbed that language and talk about that from the standpoint it really is a wholesale substitution, and it's a decision that really hasn't been made under the statute, Your Honors. And if you were to cite Wesley and you were going to talk about what was done in this case, the circumstances of this case would require that it not be allowed in any event.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I read that language as signifying something sort of entirely different. That is to say, we need not and do not decide whether one expert affidavit can amend the different expert. I read that language as suggesting there's no limit because these aren't the affidavits of the experts. They're the affidavit of the party. And the party, as I read Wesley v. Floor, can amend the affidavit by substituting new witnesses. And I can't tell from Wesley why they can't substitute new damage claims or new causation claims. I can't see anything in there. How do you help me out?
That wasn't the issue in Wesley. That wasn't what the court was faced. And so I guess I'm just saying that this to the extent that the court reserved that kind of decision making, it might not specifically line up directly with the issue that it said it didn't reach in Wesley because it wasn't faced with the issue that we have in our case. But I would say that that's the segue to allow that in the circumstances that this case presents, wholesale substitution, new experts, new opinions, which aren't even an effort to amend the prior 180-day disclosure, that's not allowed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
If I may, I'd like to circle back, Judge Bradfold, to the question that you asked me, because I did a rather poor job of answering what's in the record. So I'm going to direct you to our addendum at page 40 and page 42, which reprint the transcript of the enlargement argument that Mr. Crosby had. And just very briefly, I'm going to reference from page 11 of that transcript, line 22, Mr. Crosby is called upon by the court because he has a furrowed brow. And what's causing this? And he says, I just strongly disagree with what counsel just said, that your decision on enlargement is dispositive of this case. And he begins to explain why. At page 13, which is at addendum 42, beginning at page 4 and continuing to beginning at line 4, continuing to page 15, he says, and even if this court doesn't enlarge it, we've submitted to counsel before he can make his 145-682 motion to dismiss our case, we've submitted affidavits that are sufficient to meet the standard of care, causation, and negligence. So perhaps we did not articulate it as clearly as we could, but pretty clearly from this transcript, the affidavits we gave were substitute, and that was drawn to the attention of the trial court. She was placed in an awkward position here given the very unusual procedural context, but pretty clearly we wanted those substitute affidavits considered, and I believe we're entitled to do that under the statute. I want to cover several other quick points. The Hebrink case decided by this court explains that where a trial judge does act sua sponte on dismissal, that that is to be reversed where it causes prejudice to the other party. A motion was noted, papers were filed for dismissal, but no one moved for dismissal, and we were deprived of the opportunity to argue that. The dismissal should not have been the sua sponte remedy. We should have at least been entitled to a hearing, and reversal and remand is required on that reason alone. On Morello, that is a decision which has some useful analysis, but it analyzes where the plaintiff creates an entirely new cause theory or cause of action by a substitute affidavit, and that's where this court drew the line. You can amend the theories that you have going and articulate them more full-voiced manner or more supported, but you can't bring in an entirely new theory. That was the holding in the Morello case, and we're nowhere near that. This is the original theories that the plaintiff is merely expounding on. So Morello provides very little substance for this court to inform its decision. On the notion that so much time has passed that the defense is prejudiced, I simply have to observe that in the manner in which we do these things, a case has to have progressed to the point that discovery has begun, and that can take a matter of 50 to 90 days. Then, once discovery has begun, there is a 180-day time period to submit the initial affidavits. We're roughly three-fourths of a year into a case by that point. Then, thereafter, when the defense eventually does point to deficiencies, then we have 45 days to cure. So some time does go by, but that is a combination of the actions of both parties in the case, and each bear a responsibility in moving the matter along with the court. But most fundamentally, what I want to leave you with is the language of the statute itself in subdivision 6C, because it makes incumbent on what you're correct, Judge Bradfield, the decision in Wesley called these elements, but it says in subdivision 6C, failure to comply with the subdivision 4 because of deficiencies results in mandatory dismissal upon motion for the experts, provided that, one, the motion to dismiss identifies claimed deficiencies. The motion to dismiss never identified claims deficiencies. That came later in a brief and were timely from that. Two, the time for the hearing is at least 45 days from the service of the motion. As originally noted, the hearing was on February 22nd, 28 days later. That got cured. We're not complaining about the 45 days. We still haven't had a hearing. It's now been approximately 275 days since their complaint. We're waiting for our hearing. Third, and most importantly, before the hearing on the motion, the plaintiff does not serve an amended affidavit, and we did, and it should have been considered. For those reasons, we respectfully request reversal of the trial court in this matter. Thank you very much for your good questions.
And thank you for your argument, and to both counsel for your argument, both in writing and orally today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory period. We do have one more case on our oral calendar, but that is scheduled to be heard by interactive television, and so we need to take a few moments to set that up. We are in recess.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.